listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is January 7th, 2019. Today on the podcast, we will be joined by Dr. Deborah Giles, and she wears a variety of different hats, but generally, she is a killer whale biologist who has dedicated her life and her time to helping the endangered southern resident killer whales that we see here in Puget Sound. But before then, I'd like to just send out a couple of reminders of some upcoming events. The first is January 26th. It is Orca Network's Ways of Whales workshop, and it's up in Coopville on Whidbey Island. This is a really interesting workshop where they do it every year in January, and they're bringing in different speakers. And actually, headlining this event is Dr. Deborah Giles, and she will be giving a Southern Resident Orca research update. So if you enjoy listening to Giles in this podcast, you might want to consider heading up to Whidbey Island for Ways of the Whales workshop. They will also have a special performance by Dana Lyons of the Great Salish Sea. So check that out at orcanetwork.org. Also, save the date for January 27th. That's a Sunday, the day after the Ways of Whales workshop. It will be our first Whale Scout Helping Out event of 2019, and we're working at a really neat private property site on Kelsey Creek in Bellevue. So head up to whalescout.org or our Facebook page to look for information on that event. We will be asking people to sign up ahead of time, and then we will email you the exact location, just to be mindful of our property owners. And also keep an eye out for future events. We're working right now really hard in putting together a calendar of Whale Scout Helping Out events for the spring into summer. And it's going to be absolutely packed. There is so much work to get done. So we are really excited to be putting together all sorts of Earth Day events. It's going to be like Earth Month in April. Plus, in June is Orca Month. So there's even more really exciting activities and ways to get involved that are just right around the corner. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Deborah Giles. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast, everybody. I am joined by Dr. Deborah Giles, who just goes by the name Giles. So how are you doing, Giles?
I'm great today. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on today. So you wear a lot of different hats. I'm going to name a few, and then you can fill in all the ones that I have not included. So you are the science advisor for Orca Salmon Alliance. You also are a scientist with Wild Orca, Conservation Canines. You teach at the Friday Harbor Labs, and you serve on the Vessel and the Prey Working Groups for the Orca Task Force. What have I missed?
Those are the big ones, for sure. I do some consulting work for a nonprofit here on San Juan Island called Friends of the San Juans. When they can't have a representative going to meetings and they've got comments to make, I'll go on behalf of them if I'm going anyhow, so that's pretty great. And then I also am a contract researcher for NOAA. I do some field-based data collection for a couple of different projects for NOAA.
Wonderful. And how did you get started studying killer whales?
Well, I fell in love with them at a young age and got to see southern resident killer whales for the first time. I got to see southern resident killer whales for the first time over 32 years ago and just dedicated my life to them at that point. I didn't know how I was going to go to work for them, but that phrase always was in the back of my head, that I wanted to work for the southern residents. And so it took me a couple of years, but I ended up meeting a gentleman here on San Juan Island who was the director of the museum, the Whale Museum, Albert Shepherd. And he challenged me to quit my job and go to school and come back and do an internship with the Whale Museum. And again, it took me a couple of years to make that happen, but I did that and was the full-time intern for the Soundwatch Boater Education Program for the Whale Museum in 2005. And then I was hired, thanks to Carrie Kosky, who started that program, who she was an amazing, still is an amazing mentor, introduced me to all of the key players that do work on the Southern Residents. And so starting in 2006, I ended up being hired by NOAA to do well behavior data collection for them. And at that point, I was able to pilot a piece of equipment that I helped develop that allowed me ultimately to complete my master's and my PhD studying the Southern Residents and looking at changes in well behavior in relation to different bathymetry, so different geographic regions, and then also in relation to different numbers of vessels and how those vessels were operating and at what distances. And so then starting in 2009, I ended up combining my research project, the last of my research for my PhD, with Dr. Sam Wasser's program. And in order to get a boat off the water, we combined our studies, and I ended up driving for that boat. And I've been a part of that amazing program ever since. So I'm the vessel captain for the University of Washington Center for Conservation Biology and their Conservation Canines program, where we use a scat detection dog on the front of the boat to sniff out killer whale feces, and then we analyze that for everything from toxins to stress hormones, pregnancy hormones. It's a pretty fabulous project where it's non-invasive. We utilize dogs that are saved from shelters, and we're able to study endangered species without coming into contact with them. And through that program, we're able to answer questions related to all three of the main identified threats to this population of killer whales. So toxins and lack of prey and increasing vessel and associated noise in their habitat.
And will you continue the Conservation Canines work into this summer, or where do your future plans lie?
Yes, actually, we are assuming we can find funding. That's my main job these days, is looking for funding for that. As I said, I think it's an amazing program. We've actually added transient killer whale feces. We added that in 2018, and in order to do comparison studies between those two ecotypes. And then also in starting this year, 2019, we have applied to NOAA to collect fecal matter on all of the locally occurring baleen whales in order to be able to ask ecosystem-based questions. So we'll be able to look at, I'm really excited about that. We, you know, these humpback whales are increasing in the population here in the inland waters of the Salish Sea quite significantly. And but nobody really knows what they're eating or how much. And so it'll be really good to be able to look at some of the same parameters that we look at in southern resident killer whale feces, to be able to look at the same things in mammal-eating killer whales as well as baleen whales.
So then to do that work, you have to train the dogs on humpback whale scat, right?
Yes, And so the way that we do that, the initial first couple of trials, I guess you could call them, we go fairly close to the whale, like about 200 meters away from the whales. The nice thing about baleen whales is that when they poop, their poop is massive and tends to be oily and comes to the surface and stays at the surface. And depending on what they're eating, it can be a fairly bright color. And so that's significantly different than finding fish-eating killer whale feces, which can be the size of your little fingernail and can completely blend in with the background color of the water. It does range in color depending on what they're eating and how much they're eating. And sometimes the fecal matter that we collect from southern residents are actually pretty substantial, like the size of a dinner plate sort of thing. But when you collect that and spin that down, we're lucky if we get 3 or 4 or 5 mils, which is a pretty small amount of product, if you will, or sample. The baleen whales, on the other hand, are likely going to be having fairly large bowel movements, and so we're actually pretty excited to be able to collect that. And so we do have to go probably 200 meters behind those whales and just essentially go in their fluke print. So this print of water, it's a high-tension lens of water that's created when a whale goes down on a dive and pumps their fluke stalk, their tail. this high tension water is formed, and that tends to entrain whatever's in the water column right at that point. So a couple of times of that and a couple of samples, the dogs are going to get it really quickly, and then we can back off 400 or 500 meters away from the whales and never have to come, never have to get close to them like we do for the southern residents.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is the most profound about this research. I mean, not only are you getting such rich data from the scat samples, but you're also doing it in a way that it doesn't impact the behavior and the whales. What do you think are some of the most profound results and the most important results that you're getting out of this research, and how can it be applied to future management?
Right. I'm glad you asked that, because I actually think that this research is, I know that this research is one of the most prolific as far as papers coming out of this work. And so the two most recent ones, which were, have been really important, this one came out about 4 months ago, three, four months ago, a former grad student of Dr. Sam Wasser, now a doctor herself, Jessica Lindeen. She's a toxicologist with NOAA. And she had a couple of good studies come out, but the one that just came out recently that was really important is the looking at PAH, so essentially the smog layer at the surface of the water that's created with vessels on the water. And this was not something that she was looking for. It just kind of fell out of the data, which is sometimes some of the coolest data that you end up getting. And what she looked at was fecal samples collected before the distance guideline of 200 yards went into effect, and then fecal samples after. And there was a marked difference in the amount of hydrocarbon found in the fecal samples after the distance guidelines went into effect. And so that's a really, really direct and clear connection between a management tactic and research findings. So although the distance went into effect before the research findings came out, it did show that that extra distance was a benefit to the whales. Another really important one came out in the summer of 2017, and that was the one on pregnancy loss. So those samples showed that 70% of pregnancies in southern resident killer whale females are lost spontaneously, so spontaneous miscarriages, before the calf is born viable, or the calves die right after. So that's a huge number of pregnancy losses, and that's a separate number from what we have commonly historically thought of as the amount of the percentage of calves that are lost to females who are having their first calf or a calf after a long span. So we know that. Or we think that 50% of calves, you know, basically statistically speaking, about 50% of calves born don't make it past their first year. So that's a separate number. And then you add on top of the losses of these fetuses, it just is, it's a really clear indication that this population is not recovering in a healthy way. And what we end up seeing is that the losses, those spontaneous miscarriages, are very directly tied to nutritional health of the females. So when the females are not getting enough to eat throughout their entire pregnancy, their body naturally has to do something to change their lack of nutrition. And so they spontaneously abort or spontaneously miscarry their calf. And so it's not hard to understand when you know that why we haven't had a successful birth in over 3 years now, and why K-Pod, for example, hasn't had a successful birth since 2011.
Wow. So I want to ask a clarifying question here. That 70%, at what point are they able to even detect pregnancy?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty early, like within what we would consider the first trimester. Mm-hmm. Pregnancy hormones pretty easy to track, actually. And different, you can tell if a female is ovulating, you can tell if a female is pregnant, and you can tell if a female is heavily pregnant or just newly pregnant based on the different sex hormones that are secreted in the feces that are related to pregnancy.
Wow.
And so there's a high percentage, 20%+ of the losses are in late term pregnancies, which are really scary because those females, the bigger the calf, if it dies in utero, the harder it is to expel almost a full grown calf. And that's what we saw with a beloved whale, J32. She died with a full grown calf, female calf too, which was also like a triple whammy where the baby died in her and she couldn't expel it. And so she essentially, died from sepsis probably, with that dead calf inside of her. And so the complications for females, the older the fetus gets, the harder it is on the mom if she loses it.
Right. And so what are these losses and what are these data? What are they telling us need to be done? You have spent the last year practically working on the ORCA task force. What do you think needs to be done from the task force, and what has been done that's been really successful, and what still needs to happen in year two?
I think that some really good work was done. There was certainly a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of passion went into year one. I saw you at most of those meetings, so thank you for your dedication to this process as well, Whitney.
Of course.
I think that it's so important for the public to be present at these meetings. These meetings are for everybody to attend, and there is a process for the public to be able to comment, and so it is incredibly important for the task force members themselves who are doing this on a voluntary basis. There's no payment involved. It's important for them to understand what the public what the public opinion is as well. So I think some good things did come out of it. I think that it is important to let me just say that one of the most important things that has come out of the task force is the public visibility of this process and the public awareness now of the plight of these whales. The whales themselves told the story pretty poignantly throughout this last summer themselves, but having an opportunity to talk about it in the media through the lens of the task force, I think was also really, really important. So more people became aware of the plight of the whales because of the task force. So I think that in and of itself is an important success for this process. I think another thing that happened that was really good is that for the first time ever, it's gotten certain people together in a room to discuss environmental related issues in a way that has never happened before. And so I am thankful for that, and I'm glad that hopefully those communications and those relationships will continue to be built. I think the environment as a whole, some habitat restoration efforts came out on the winning side. I think that we'll see some additional state-funded and state-sponsored restoration efforts occurring because of the work that was done in year one. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of more work to be done in year two. I think that one of the most important things that did come out of year one that will be translated into year two is the development of a group that's highly, highly focused on the Snake River dams and the removal of those four dams. The way that I'm looking at that is it's going to be an opportunity for people from all sides of that issue, whether it's economic or fish related or whale related or transportation related, ag related, green energy related, all of these different, or hydro, of course, all of these different user groups or stakeholders that have a vested interest in the continuation of those dams or the removal of those dams, this is going to be the first time where all of those people, all of those experts, are going to be brought together, and it's going to be an opportunity for an unbiased arbiter, somebody that is able to look at this information, to be able to actually point across the table and say, okay, Dr. So-and-so, your science says X, and then point, two seats away to somebody else and say to them, but your science says the opposite of that. Now, we would like to have a discussion and come to a really firm understanding of what the science is. How can you have differing opinions about X, Y, or Z topic? It's going to be the first time ever that we'll have everybody in the same room to be able to discuss this, hopefully in a productive and respectful manner, but in a way that is very progressive and moves us forward, moves this dialogue forward in a way that we will finally come out of this process in year two of the task force with an understanding of why there's a difference in science and how we need to move forward. And I personally believe that is going to point to the fact that those dams, those four dams on the Snake River, need to come out. I think personally, that's, you're not asking me for my personal opinion, but that's my personal opinion, is I think when the science and the hashing out of the different results from all of these different threads can be looked at, that the final picture is going to be that the dams need to come down. And so for that, I actually look at that as a win, because like I said, it's going to be the first time where everybody's going to be in the same room, and we're going to be able to say, how can you have this finding when it's so diametrically opposed to a colleague of yours that also studies fish? Let's get to the bottom of it right now. Let's not punt this any farther. We need to hash this out right now. And I'm actually really excited about that.
Do you plan on attending?
Oh, yes.
Another thing that a lot of people who are very supportive of this recommendation and this action is that the stakeholder meetings are going to bring together the people that are going to look beyond just the science of the dams, but for the community services that the dams are supporting. Now, what's your opinion on that?
Absolutely. I think that's really critical. I think that the east side is in a, it's a unique situation where I can see why it might feel like outsiders are coming into their community and trying to make decisions that will have a direct impact on their way of life. I understand why they would feel like that. What I think is going to happen is that this process of coming to the final science, to understanding why ultimately what I think is going to show why the dams need to come down, that's not the end of the process. The end of the process is, okay, now how do we mitigate for the removal of those dams? How do we make sure that the farmers that have built their livelihood and that all of us rely on for a lot of food and wine and all kinds of things that come out of that region, the state, how can we make sure that the farmers get the water that they need? How can we make sure that we transition other people whose livelihoods are reliant on those dams? How can we transition that to a different a different way to make a living? So I think that we have to think of it as an issue of the state and an issue of the region, the broader region, state, the several states that are most impacted by the removal of the dams. And then as a nation, I think that it is important for us to understand that this shouldn't be seen as a west side versus east side. And I don't know that I would agree that the west side hasn't done enough to bridge that gap, to meet the people, to understand what their concerns are, and then to work together to try and come up with solutions, compromises that will not unduly impact somebody's livelihood. But ultimately, what I think it comes down to is us working together as a state and as a people, as a species, to try and rectify some of the harms that we have caused to the environment. Because ultimately, it really does come back to this overarching, in a way, obvious conclusion that we are all reliant on the natural world. And the healthier it is, the healthier we are. And I think undamming our rivers in areas where we can is a really great, great step to trying to pull back some of that damage, to repair some of that damage.
So you're supportive of this action, and there were a lot of other actions on the table, and that a lot of them are going to be moving forward. What else do you think is necessary to save endangered southern resident killer whales?
If we just look at the southern resident killer whales and we have them as the driving force for decisions that are made, if that is our goal, is to recover the southern resident killer whales, I think that it is going to be absolutely mandatory that the whales have an allocation of fish. So fisheries management, fisheries throughout the entire Pacific Northwest, Alaska to California. Fisheries management is a complex and often challenging arena. I recognize that there are a lot of moving parts. There are a lot of key players. There are a lot of different organizations and groups of people that come together to try and figure out how to manage fish, how to have fish wild and hatchery, how to manage fish, meaning how much can we take out of the environment. I recognize that it's an incredibly complicated and can be a thorny issue. However, I do believe that part of the problem is that we have excluded a really key player here. And by that, I mean the southern resident killer whales. I have this analogy that that's been running around in my head for the last year or so, and it's this image of people at a table playing cards, and there's this it's a complex, complicated card game, and there are these stakeholders, and they each have their own part of the deck. They each can look at their cards and see their cards and hold them or put them into play, and then there's also a part of that deck that's just those cards are just on the floor. They're part of the game. They're part of the deck, but they're not movable by the people at the table. Those cards down there on the ground, that's what fisheries managers kind of term this black box, or these oceanographic variables that get factored in before fish get divided. But before the total amount of fish that is available get divided up by the stakeholders that are at the table. And what I'm saying is that I really feel that the whales need to take some of those cards from the black box or from the floor, and the rest of the players at the table need to move over and make space for the whales. And the whales need to be able to have cards too and play those cards. And that's not happening right now. Right now, the whales don't get a piece of that pie. They don't get dealt into the game. And that's why we're not seeing them recover. These whales need a specific amount of fish per day, per whale, in order to survive. And then they need even more than that to thrive. These whales need roughly about 350 pounds of salmon per day per whale. And so when you kind of extrapolate that out, that depending on the size of salmon that you're plugging in for your calculation, is it a 15-pound salmon? Is it a 20-pound salmon? We're looking at around 410,000 or 500,000 fish a year minimum for these whales at a population of 74. As the whale population increases, obviously the amount of fish that they need is going to increase as well. But that can still be factored in. That can still, can be and should be part of the calculation that gets figured out area by area. Southeast Alaska too needs to be a part of this conversation. Fisheries management in Southeast Alaska is a big part of the equation here. because the lion's share of the fish that get caught in Alaska are not fish that are bound for Alaskan rivers. Those are fish that are bound for these rivers down here in BC, Canada, Washington, Oregon, and even as far as Northern California. And that, when you think about that, even though we get to, you know, it's some genius, marketing genius's idea to call all the fish that gets caught in Alaska, Alaskan caught wild salmon, which technically it is, caught in Alaska, but it's not Alaskan bound fish. And as a consumer, that's what we think we're buying. When we buy Alaskan caught wild salmon, we think we're buying from a sustainably harvested river. But unless you actually know the name of the river in which that fish came from, we cannot say that we're eating sustainably. And in fact, sometimes 90%+ of the fish that gets caught and gets called Alaskan caught wild salmon is actually fish bound for down here and fish that are from imperiled runs. And so while we down here in Washington have a part to play in dividing these fisheries amounts up, there's a bigger picture here. There's a bigger part. It's like we're just filling in one part of the puzzle. The whole puzzle, the whole picture involves a much, much broader area. And again, I recognize, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, I recognize that this is a complicated and sometimes thorny issue. But if we are talking about recovering the southern resident killer whales, then the whales themselves have to be factored in to all of that. And we're just, as a species ourselves, we're not yet talking about that. Not enough people are having that part of the conversation. And ultimately, what it comes down to is that fisheries management as a whole ultimately is going to have to change if we want to save southern resident killer whales. And quite honestly, Whitney, if we want to save a number of different wild salmon runs. Because it's not just, you know, we think about the whales, but the salmon themselves are imperiled. And as a human species, we tend to think that biodiversity is good. And so just from that perspective, we need to be thinking about how we can recover wild Chinook salmon in order to recover the whales, but also to recover the salmon themselves and the ecosystems in which they evolved.
Yeah,
and that's where I'd like to see us going, having those discussions in year two of the governor's task force.
And even the coastal communities that have already felt like they've been hit so hard, you know, it's about mm-hmm. rebuilding the stocks for everyone.
Absolutely.
I get the same feeling, too. Absolutely. Like as a consumer, you know, my husband likes to eat salmon. He's bonkers about all the health benefits, and I've restricted him to sockeye, which is a really small portion of the killer whale diet. I mean, like really small, and mm-hmm. also is a quite tasty fish. And because, you know, you just feel like, I know PCC decided not to sell Chinook caught in, you know, in Washington state, but as you mentioned, those fish are going up to Alaska and getting caught there and given the gold seal of approval. And as a consumer, I just don't feel like I can eat, Chinook salmon and feel really confident in it because they're all mixed together. You don't know if it's an endangered fish or not. And it just doesn't sit right with me. And, you know,
right.
The killer whales were the first fishermen, right? And they're clearly
yeah.
not getting enough. So seems like they need
right.
a bit of a boost. You know, one thing.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, we can. This is kind of a crazy thing, though, if you think about it. So not last year, but the year before, I heard a story. It was actually on television, and it showed a picture of the Pike Place Market with the fishmongers and the guys that throw the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was about the spring the spring Chinook coming from Copper River.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody hears, oh, Copper River Chinook salmon, that's amazing salmon. That's a sustainably harvested, a sustainably managed river. Well, that fish was $70 a pound.
Wow.
That's how you know you're eating a Chinook salmon that's sustainably harvested. the price of it is going to be significantly higher, because honestly, that's the price of a salmon.
Yeah.
That's what it costs to do sustainable fisheries.
Yeah.
When you right next to that Chinook salmon that's from Copper River that has a $70 price tag on it, if you get $14 a pound salmon, Chinook salmon right next to it, the bulk of, and it says Alaskan caught wild salmon on there, you have no idea where that fish came from. And the difference in price is what tells you whether or not that's sustainable.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's something that as consumers, we need to know more about. And right now, it's hard to find out that information. So if you're going to buy Chinook salmon and you can afford it, make sure you're buying it from a river that where it says where it's from. And even if that means it says Skagit River Chinook salmon, we probably should be buying from Skagit River Chinook, because then we know that it's gotten past the whales. The whales have, if Skagit is again, it means that they're doing terminal fisheries in order to be able to say definitively this fish is from this river. And when you do terminal fishery, it means that the fish have already gone past the whales. The whales have already had their crack at it.
Right. So a terminal fishery means that instead of fishing out in the open where everything is mixed up and all the fish are all mixed together, but we're rather fishing mm-hmm. closer to the mouths of these rivers, where we know that those fish are going back to that river and they've already made their ocean journey and they've already made it past the orcas and they're back at their rivers.
It. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea. I know that a lot of groups have been pushing for this and trying to move this forward for the orcas. So it's a really interesting idea. Do you have any other further thoughts on terminal fisheries?
Yeah, you know, it is there would be a lot of problems to work out if we made the decision to move to a terminal fishery, not the least of which is that the treaty tribes are guaranteed 50% of all the fish that is allowable to be caught every year. And that was something that I will never be anybody that thinks that they shouldn't have that allocation. The treaty tribes gave up everything except that. And for a lot of tribal members, this fish is the only protein that they get. And so I think it's really important to be mindful and thoughtful of that. For those tribes that don't have rivers within their historical range, I still think that we can come up with solutions for, and again, you know, these management changes can be temporary. They can be where we allow the fish runs to rebound, and then we go back and do our fisheries management in a slightly more mindful manner than we probably currently are. But in the meantime, while we're giving the fish a break, while we're thinking about and maybe switching over to a terminal fishery type harvest, I don't see why there couldn't be a co-op sort of situation where the fish end up getting divided equally and equitably amongst the people that have a legal right and a cultural and religious and historical right to that fish. So again, I feel like I'm a little bit out of my depths, because this is, I have spent my career studying southern resident killer whales, more along the behavior side of it. But in the last year or two, I've become a lot more entrenched with trying to understand and help be part of the solution to understand more of what the threats are for this population. And so fisheries is something that I'm just starting to sink my teeth into. I'm thinking of 2019 as my year of salmon, and not in the sense that I'm eating it, but in the sense that I want to learn everything I can about it. And what we're talking about right now with changes to fisheries management, changes to fisheries harvest techniques, all of these things are going to be a part of it. And I look forward to having additional conversations throughout year two with people that certainly have a deeper history with this subject, to learn more and hopefully come up with some ideas that are going to be palatable to everybody that needs to be in this conversation. And I just really want to hope that the whales get invited to the table in a way that so far they never have been. That's my job, is to push for that.
Yeah.
Ask for the whales to have a space.
Yes, because I found that just really cool. At the beginning, you said that you work for the whales. So that's a kind of cool perspective to have.
Thank you. Yeah. it leads me in everything that I do.
Yeah. It's a great thing to think about. A few years ago, I took a class on salmon at a local environmental education center, but it was taught by a college professor, and I took it with a couple other Whale Scout volunteers that knew more about salmon going in than I did, admittedly. And it just blew my mind. And I think it's really important for people to go out and see the fish and then start learning about them. Because I have to admit, when I first started being bonkers about killer whales, studying the salmon was not of interest to me at all. And as soon as I started getting into it, it just blew my mind. And now it is an obsession. I'm reading books about salmon all the time. And so it's been a really cool thing. And I encourage everyone to follow in Giles' footsteps, doing the same thing. I've got a couple mailbag questions. The first one is from Michelle. And she says, I love that you've been willing to express your feelings to reporters as well as giving scientific facts. As a female scientist, what has been your thought process when deciding to admit openly that these losses feel devastating and make you sad? I think we're seeing a real shift in scientists feeling it's okay to admit that they care and it doesn't diminish the science. What has been your experience?
I like that you say that there's been a shift. I hope there's been a shift, or I hope a shift is occurring. I will say that I have been told not that long ago that I can't both be a scientist and an advocate, and I don't believe that. I studied, so my background academic training is in the discipline of conservation biology. That's a discipline that was started in 1985 by Dr. Michael Soule, who is a professor. He's still living, actually. I would love to meet him someday. In California at the UC system, I think in Berkeley was where he ended up. But he coined this phrase, conservation biology. And the subject of conservation biology, if you haven't had a chance to read about it, I would highly suggest a paper. It's called What is Conservation Biology? It's free, open access. You can just get it online. And it was written by Soule in 1985. And in that, he lays out these tenets of conservation biology. And one of them is that that as scientists, it's our responsibility to put our science in the hands of policymakers, especially when we're talking about species that are highly imperiled. And so when I learned that as a undergrad and then later studied it as a grad student, that philosophy really resonated with me. And so when I, as I said recently, I have had a colleague who I respect very, very much literally tell me I can't do both. It casts a shadow on my science, on my ability to be unbiased and scientific. And I think that is absolutely not the correct way to be thinking. We don't have time. This planet doesn't have time for me to be able to just do science and put it on a shelf and hope a policymaker will put their hands on it. Rather, it's my responsibility, and especially because I get to study the southern resident killer whales. It is literally my dream. I'm literally living my dream from when I was 18 years old. I would feel I don't have a choice. It's my rent for getting to be one of the few people that get to study these whales. It's my responsibility to be out there and to help to be their voice. And so it is hard. You know, I'll admit that the article, and I've told Linda this, the article during the summertime when she wrote in there that the headline was, I'm sobbing. I was mortified when I saw that headline. because I knew that people would take that and ridicule my emotion and my sentiment. Ultimately, it doesn't matter to me what other people think. It matters to me that I can use my science and that I can take that and hopefully do good for the planet and for the species that I'm trying to recover. And so I feel very honored and thankful that I get to work for Dr. Sam Wasser, who is the endowed chair for the Center for Conservation Biology. He's another person that has put his heart and his science on his sleeve, and he will put it in the hands of anybody that will take it. And I think that as scientists, we have to do that. If we're serious about recovering the animals, we cannot be silent when we know, when we have science that will help understand and help policymakers make the right decisions.
And
so I don't want to say it's embarrassing. It's shocking when when I see things that I've said to reporters actually come out in print, because I'm a fairly open person. Giles, the scientist, and Giles, the person at a dinner party, is the same person. I don't have a different way of thinking about life in those different parts of my life. And so when I'm having an interview with somebody, I just speak from the heart and I speak from the science and I talk about data and I talk about how that matters to the whales. It is a little surprising sometimes to see things like I am sobbing. I didn't say I was sobbing. I was literally sobbing because it was like day number 14 and I was just so worried about J35's mental health and physical health from carrying around this baby. And I just, I'm human and I'm going to be touched by that. And anybody that says that they aren't is not probably being honest with themselves.
Yeah.
And so it is what it is. And I hope that there's a change, because I think that scientists have an awful lot of good stuff to say that can help inform these discussions and ultimately help the whales and everything that they need to be healthy.
And for sure, you are not the only one sobbing. I can promise you that. Our second mailbag question is from Jill, and this is sort of a related question. She says, everything seems so dismal when we are bombarded with so much bad news. So, Giles, how do you stay positive, and what hope can you put out in the universe to counteract the negative?
The thing that I've been doing is talking with people that feel the same way that I do, being in groups of people that understand where you're coming from and where you can talk openly and honestly about what's happening and be able to express your anger and fear and worry openly is really important. And I would highly encourage anybody that can form your own grief group, because ultimately what it ends up being, it gives you an opportunity to talk about your grief. But my experience is that it also is really empowering in that, A, you're with other people that feel the same, and it always, it seems like, ends up in a way of, okay, well, what can we do? Where can we go from here? And it becomes a positive thing. And then, honestly, I have students that ask me, how can you keep studying this population of animals when it seems like they're doomed?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're doomed yet. I really don't think they're doomed. We're getting low. We're at 74. I think that the social structure, the population dynamics are different than when the whales stopped being captured in 76. We had 1976, we had 71 individuals, and granted the sex and age ratios were in better favor. It was better for the whales then. But I still think that the population as a whole can rebound. If we take the necessary steps, if we start changing our business model here, and by that I mean everything having to do with large, fast-moving ships and toxins being dumped into the environment and our fisheries management, if we get a handle on that and we move quickly, I honestly believe that these whales are not past recovery. The other thing to think about, and I always think about this as a scientist, is that everything that we're learning from research protocols, research questions, the findings from different research projects, how communities can and do come together to work together to solve problems, to clean up rivers, to plant rivers, like Whale Scout has been amazing leaders in that realm in our region. Thank you so much for that work.
Thank you for saying that.
Those sorts of things are so important. And I think that ultimately what we're doing here can be used as a model for other regions around the planet that have imperiled populations of animals or plants even, or even ecosystems or habitat types, habitat regions. We can use what we're doing here as a model. And so hopefully people around the world would learn this lesson and move more quickly before it gets to be as dire as it is in this region for the salmon and for the whales and for the ecosystems that both of those rely on. But that's a really empowering thing too, is to know that you're part of something that's bigger than what's happening here. The fact that there are people literally around the world that you can talk to them and they can tell you who J35 is. They can tell you who her mother is.
Yeah.
They can tell you who J50 was. That is astonishing, and it's beautiful. And I think that we need to embrace that as a community. We need to come together as a community and as a whole and work together, either pushing on the same issue or pushing in different arenas to better the environment and better the way that we're make positive change in the way that we're relating to the environment. And we all just have to keep working, because we're the ones that got us here, and we're the ones that have the power to get us out of this. And I am hopeful, and I don't think that that's me just being a Pollyanna. I think that the science supports the idea that it's not too late.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, and it inspires me. I want to thank you so much for coming on our podcast today. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you very, very much.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure, and I just adore what you're doing, and thank you for including me in it. I feel honored to be a part of this.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. As always, if you like this podcast, go up to iTunes and hit subscribe, and those shows will be sent directly to your phone or mobile device or your laptop. You can listen to us on your way to work or when you're out on a walk, anywhere you go. There are all sorts of other podcasts in our archives at whalescout.org. And so you can scan back and listen to all sorts of interviews, special guests throughout the years. Thank you so much for listening. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.
Bah, le type est trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé qu'écrasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.